debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The headline on by Jessica Schulberg over on Huffington Post, controversial Trump aide Catherine Gorka helped end funding for group that fights white supremacy. Way back last January, the Department of Homeland Security officially awarded a $400,000 grant to a group called, as part of its Countering Violent Extremism program, to a group called Life After Hate, which works to de-radicalize neo-Nazis. Sebastian Gorka's wife, according to this article in the Huffington Post, played a role in killing that. This is very strange. On the line with us is Tony McAleer. He is a former organizer with the White Aryan Resistance and currently the board chair and co-founder of lifeafterhate.org, the organization I was just telling you about that Catherine Gorka is, helped defund. You can tweet him at lifeafterhate or at McAleer, the website lifeafterhate.org. Tony, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. You are right now running an organization that helps basically Nazis overcome their... Well, I shouldn't be describing it. You should. Tell me what your organization does.
Well, we help people leave the place where we once were. And the mission statement, which kind of describes sort of how we do it, of Life After Hate, is to inspire individuals and communities to a place of compassion and forgiveness for themselves and for all people. And I think when we can get those two things in balance, someone who has those in balance can't hold that type of ideology.
So what took you into the White Aryan Resistance and what got you out of it?
Well, if I go back and look at my life, you know, I came, you know, there's nothing that stands out as extraordinary. I was a white upper middle class kid. My father was a psychiatrist. Perhaps that explains it. I think I was this, if I look at who little Tony was, I was this bright, sensitive, curious, mischievous, a little stubborn and defiant little kid, growing up in a household and a school where it wasn't safe to be that. And at the age of 10, I walked in on my father with another woman. And that was sort of when, the god fell off the pedestal, so to speak, and my parents became all too human, and that left me really angry and confused, and I started to act out at school, and I went from a straight A student in grade 5 to C student in grade six, and I went to an all-boys Catholic school. And my parents and the school, in their wisdom, decided they came to an agreement that they would try and beat the grades into me. And if I didn't get an A or a B on major tests or assignments, I was marched down to the teacher's office and hit on the rear end with a yardstick. And in those moments over and over again in that office, I don't think I ever, even to this day, felt more powerless than I did then. And I went from listening to Queen and Elton John to The Clash and the Sex Pistols, and a really, really angry and disruptive at school, and got into the punk scene, and that led to the skinhead scene, and the first skinheads I met actually wanted to rob me for my Doc Martens. And my bullying survival strategy was befriend the bully, become the bully. And in order for me to have their protection, I had to have their respect. And in order for me to have their respect, I had to commit all the same acts of violence that they did. But I felt powerful at the time. And I don't want to blame anything on my childhood. Everything I did, I chose to do. And I share my childhood to offer an insight into the lens through which I made those decisions. The analogy I like to use is, have you ever been to the grocery store when you're really hungry and you make those unhealthy choices?
Oh, yeah.
Very different choices than when you're healthy. I went out into the world as a young man emotionally hungry, and the choices I made were extremely harmful to society, harmful to all kinds of individuals, which I hurt with my violence, and communities that I hurt with my words, and it hurt me.
I remember quite vividly back in the 60s and 70s, Ted Patrick, a friend of mine, Hilly Zeitlin, some other people, who worked to deprogram people who had been basically captured by cults like the Moonies and Guru Maharaji and the Perfect Master, this 13-year-old kid who, and all this stuff that you may be too young to remember, but it strikes me that there are some parallels here between the kind of deprogramming they were doing and what you're doing, or is there not? Do you see yourself as a deprogrammer or as a safe place? And are you finding that most of the people that you're helping get out of the skinhead Nazi white racist white supremacist world have, you know, backstories similar to yours of a childhood feeling disempowered and frightened?
Absolutely. And for us to go in and try and tackle the ideology head on is a big challenge, because at this point, you know, for myself, and it's true for others, ideology and identity become intertwined. And if you attack someone's ideology that's in that place, you attack their identity and they shut down and you don't get anywhere. What we find, and the University of Maryland did a research from their studies of terrorism and responses to terrorism program, and they found the number one correlated factor in the history of someone joining a violent extremist group was childhood trauma. And they were sort of talking about the physical side of childhood trauma, but I think it's more about the emotional side, because you can have emotional trauma without a physical component. And I think what it does is, it to a young person at a deep subconscious level, John Bradshaw is a great author that I think explains it really well with his Healing the Shame That Binds You. We come out of a childhood with this toxic shame, the feeling that we're not good enough, we're not smart enough, we're not lovable, we're insignificant. And we go out in the world and live our lives in reaction to that. And for him, toxic shame was the root of all addiction, but I think it's the root of all gangs. It's the root of a whole spectrum of antisocial outcomes, of which violent extremism is one. We look at the young men who were arrested for the ISIS attacks in Brussels and Paris. We don't see people who were dedicated to Islam or people who found ISIS through the Quran. They were troubled youth. And I think it's that sense of search for belonging, identity, community, and a sense of purpose where there is none. And the fuel behind that is shame. I think shame is the driver for both shame at an individual level and collective shame. I think structural racism creates shame. Islamophobia creates shame. Overt racism creates shame. Bullying creates shame. And shame is the, you know, if you look at what is the opposite word to shame, and there's two that often come to mind, and it's pride and honor. And these movements are like a hyper expression and an unhealthy false expression of pride and restoring lost honor.
So how do you meet that need for pride and honor in people who are leaving an organization that lavishes it upon them and you know, gives them the opportunity to flaunt themselves on national television, as we saw this last weekend? How do you do that?
Well, it's the opposite. The way to heal and the antidote to shame is compassion. So we treat them with compassion and try to reconnect them to their humanity. And it's like more of a healing process, because I believe that the level to which we dehumanize other human beings is a reflection of how disconnected and dehumanized we are inside. And when we can make that reconnection happen, then it's possible to recognize the humanity in others, and it changes things. If I share with you the stories, and I'll share with you my own story of how we come back from that. Compassion, a story of compassion shows up, and it shows up in two major ways. One is the birth of a child, and anecdotally, it seems to be a female child. I think there's something about that feminine energy being introduced into the hypermasculine that has a transformative effect. And children are safe to love. For me, it was safe for me to let down my guard and my shield and my mask of who I had become, to protect that sensitive little Tony, because they're incapable of harming and shaming and ridiculing. It's safe to love a child. It's a safe space to open up. And that began the thawing process for me. The second part was receiving compassion from someone who I didn't feel I deserved it from. And sort of about 8 years after I had left the movement, and the movement hadn't quite left me, I'd sort of still harbored a lot of that stuff. I started doing some personal growth work and ego work and law of attraction stuff. And the guy who ran the course, I really connected with him, and he was also a counselor. So my friend for my birthday gave me a one-on-one counseling session. And I'm sitting there telling him for the first time, because I carried so much shame about the things that I had done. And when I had revealed in the past, or people had found out in the past, I lost friendships and whole social circles. So I was always very guarded with this. And I spilled my guts to him, and he looks at me and he starts smiling. And I look at him and I go, what's so funny? This is odd, right? This is my first therapy session, and I wasn't expecting that reaction. And he says, you know, I was born Jewish, right? And here's a man who I admire, respected, considered, a friend, a man who loved me, wanted to see me heal, and offering me this compassion and seeing the human inside me when I was incapable of seeing it. Yet I had once advocated for the destruction of him and his people. That was mind-blowing. And these stories of compassion show up over and over and over again in the stories of people that have left this type of hatred behind. When we're compassionate with someone, what we do is we hold up a mirror and we allow them to see the humanity that they don't normally see reflected back at them through our compassion. And when we can reconnect people to their humanity, the ideology doesn't make any sense anymore. The foundation of separation that holds it up disappears.
That's remarkable. The organization is lifeafterhate.org, and you can tweet at lifeafterhate. Tony McAleer, former organizer with the White Aryan Resistance, now the board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate. And they're in a bit of a pinch right now, since the Gorka family has essentially, apparently, according to this article in Huffington Post, gone after them. So I encourage you to check out their website, lifeafterhate.org. Tony, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you very much.
It's a good, powerful and compelling story. It's great talking. Oh, Richard Spencer said that has now come out, this from TPM Matt Shuham. In today's TPM, white supremacist leader Richard Spencer asserted Monday that President Donald Trump wasn't being serious when he denounced hate groups by name. Spencer said at a press conference, "You can say racism is evil. We should all love one another. The sun should always shine 7 days a week. Everyone should be above average. Everyone should be a wonderful athlete. Everyone should love each other. It's just silliness. It's not serious, and I don't think anyone takes it seriously, including the president," is what Richard Spencer, the head Nazi here in the United States, had to say. Or the guy who's doing the,
Sieg Heil, or the Hail Victory with the Nazi salute. Sieg Heil means Hail Victory. And he was also saying Hail Trump. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. But the amazing thing to me, the absolutely amazing thing to me that I totally missed on Saturday was, you know, keep in mind, the entire thing in Charlottesville, and my apologies for calling it Charlotte yesterday. I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, and right down the road is Charlotte, Michigan. Anyhow, the main point of what happened in Charlottesville was these right-wing Nazis and Klan members protesting the removal of Robert E. Lee. Their cherished history, the cherished history of the South, is all over the right-wing and Nazi movements, and the so-called Confederate movement, this cherished history. And I totally missed when Trump on Saturday said this.
This can happen. My administration is restoring the sacred bonds of loyalty between this nation and its citizens. But our citizens must also restore the bonds of trust and loyalty between one another. We must love each other, respect each other, and cherish our history.
And cherish our history? Really? Cherish our history? I mean, it was just this is the sentence after the, you know, on all sides, right? When he said on all sides. And somehow they cut this part out when they play it on the news over and over again. Cherish our history was an open shout out that had to have been written by one of the white nationalists in the White House. I mean, Donald Trump is not sophisticated or subtle enough to slip that in. And by the way, he gave this speech before Heather Heyer was murdered. Cherish our history. Yes, you guys, let's cherish that statue to Robert E. Lee, that treasonous, traitorous general. It's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing that you know, the rest. Jake Tapper pointed this out on Sunday, apparently. I found this just, you know, the DuckDuckGoing the thing. But it just kind of went down, you know, it never went beyond that. Trump was shouting out. This is why he didn't want to say, you know, he didn't want to call them out by name. He was shouting out to them. These are his people. My shaves were super frustrating before Harry's came along. I just didn't get that close shave and smooth glide that Harry's provides. I use Harry's because it's the best shave for me, and now Louise is using Harry's too. She loves the smooth, close glide on her legs. Harry's is a high-quality shave that's better for your face and your legs and your wallet. Great news. Harry's is so confident you'll love their blades, they're giving you their set for free. Just cover the shipping. Free trial set includes ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision-engineered blades, the lubricating strip and the trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and the travel blade cover. I've partnered with Harry's to bring you this incredible offer. Head over to harrys.com/Tom, that's T-H-O-M, to get it now. Get started with Harry's today and get their free trial offer. Guess what? It's free. Yes. All you cover is just a few bucks in shipping. To get your free trial set, including the handle, blade, shave gel, and travel blade cover, go over to harrys.com/Tom. That's Harry's, harrys.com/Tom. Don't wait. Get started with Harry's today. harrys.com/Tom. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. A couple of quick things. The phone lines are all lit up. People want to talk about all kinds of stuff, and we will get to that in just a second. But there's so much going on, so much news. I received an email from Credo Action. The website is credoaction.com, credoaction.com. And it says, fresh off renewing the racist war on drugs and boosting private prisons, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is now going after sick people. In a private letter to congressional leaders, now this is a letter that Sessions sent to Republicans in Congress. Sessions demanded permission to prosecute medical marijuana providers and patients. They point out in states where medical marijuana is permitted, fewer people get hooked on dangerous opioids. Sessions' dangerous crusade will put sick folks at risk and supercharge the opioid epidemic. He's going after sick people. Sessions personally requested that the Senate Appropriations Committee reject an amendment in place since 2014 that bans the Department of Justice, which is what Jeff Sessions runs, from interfering with states that permit medical marijuana distribution, use, or possession. In other words, if you are a legal medical marijuana user, Jeff Sessions wants to arrest you and put you in jail. He's coming for you. And he's asked the Republicans in the House of Representatives and the Senate to give him the power to do that. I don't know why this is not at the top of the news. This is pretty mind-boggling stuff. This is just kind of by way of letting you know about something that I thought was really cool. Code Pink, you know, Medea Benjamin's a frequent guest on our program. Code Pink is a great organization that I'm a big supporter of. And I wanted to go on this trip. We just have so much coming up between now and the end of the year that I'm not able to. In fact, Louise and I damn near did it, but we just couldn't make it work. But they're planning a trip to Cuba in October, around Halloween time. And they say it will visit rural farms and urban co-ops, listen to some of the island's best musicians, visit the homes of fantastic artists, tour the medical school that trains students from around the world, meet with representatives of the National Assembly, hear from brilliant professors and inspiring students, enjoy the world-famous beaches that Donald Trump doesn't want you to visit, get a spectacular tour of Havana, travel to the countryside, and more. And they're also going to have Trump's policies or scary blowout Halloween party with their Cuban partners, complete with the world's best music and mojitos. So if you want the information on that, get over to codepink.org. And finally, this, well, not finally, I've got a whole bunch more stuff here, which we will get to as we continue through the program. But have you ever heard of Directive 30? Directive 30, Matthew Desam has a piece on Slate.com today that's absolutely brilliant. And I was unfamiliar with this, and he reprints it. Directive 30 was issued in May of 1946. After World War II was over, this was a directive from the U.S. military, U.S., to the U.S. military and all the Germans in Germany. And it basically, you know, on or after the date of this directive, the planning, designing, erection, installation, posting, or other display of any monument, memorial, poster, statue, edifice, street or highway name marker, emblem, tablet, or insignia, which tends to preserve and keep alive the German military tradition, to revive militarism, or to commemorate the Nazi Party, or which is of such a nature as to glorify incidents of war, and the functioning of military museums and exhibitions, and the erection, installation, or posting of other displays on a building or other structure of any of the same will be prohibited and declared illegal. Also prohibited and declared illegal, the reopening of military museums and exhibitions. Every existing monument, poster, statue, edifice, street or highway name marker, emblem, tablet, or insignia of a type, the planning, designing, erection, installation, posting, or other display of which is prohibited in paragraph one, which I just read to you, must be completely destroyed and liquidated by 1 January 1947. Also, all military museums and exhibitions must be closed and liquidated by 1 January 1947 throughout the entire German territory. And then after the 1st of January, after all this stuff has been destroyed, on or after 1 January 1947, the retention or display knowingly of any monument, memorial, poster, statue, edifice, military museum or exhibition, street or highway name marker, emblem, tablet or insignia of a type, the planning, designing, erection, installation, or posting of or other display of which is prohibited by paragraph one, and the destruction of which is required by paragraph two of this directive, will be prohibited and declared illegal. Why the hell didn't we do this after the Civil War? We had a four-year war where a group of traitorous, treasonous slaveholders and who wanted to preserve the institution of slavery, which is exactly what North Carolina said in their secession document, or maybe it was South Carolina, in their secession document. It was South Carolina. Thank you, Troy. It was all about slavery, they said. Why are we not going around and just simply destroying these monuments? This is not anybody's heritage who is alive today. This is an evil and dark part of our past. So anyhow, that's a couple of things here. Pick up your phone calls. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Well, I sort of changed a bit what I wanted to say. I haven't heard anything from Donald Trump condemning as an act of terrorism the bombing of a mosque in Bloomington, where the Mall of America is. It's a suburb of Minneapolis. And the only time he came here and the only thing he ever said about the Somali community was very negative. Right. He came here, he was here about 15 minutes to the Humphrey Terminal, got off the plane and made some snarky comment about Somalis. You know, so that's one thing.
Yeah, so for people who don't realize or who don't know what you're talking about, there's a large Somali community in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Some refugees, some simply expats, but there's and Somalis, of course, from Somalia, you know, which is part of Africa, are black and therefore, you know.
And actually they got here because they found that people in positions of power, like politicians, i.e. Rudy Perpich, and who was a governor, you know, he started the Center for the Victims of Torture. So this state has long been very welcoming, either through churches, NGOs, or even governmental agencies, to invite people from war-torn places. I think it was because, you know, people who came here with nothing, who were basically pushed out of their homelands. There was like two classes in Norway or in Sweden or in other places, and they were just dirt poor, and they came here, and they were so happy that they, you know, made it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and it's not my heritage at all. I'm Italian, part Jewish, and somewhat Scots-Irish. And, you know, but I've always been impressed with, you know, that bent in and the goodwill of people in Minnesota. But I did want to speak a bit about Christianity and like the KKK usurping symbols of Christianity. And I think that the problem with Christianity, and I am a very devoted Christian, but I do see when it aligns itself with state power, and, you know, then allows itself to be used, you know, and the idea of, the apostles, when they went to speak to the Colossians, they accepted anything that was of good repute, was beautiful, was acceptable, art, literature, whatever it was that they produced. The liturgy I celebrated today myself is built on the Jewish temple worship. So, you know, Christianity started out very syncretic, and it, you know, it still should be that way. It shouldn't, you know, true Christianity doesn't go in and denigrate other people's religions. It takes from their religion, their philosophy, their culture, and it works with that. That's what you're supposed to do. That's how they evangelized within the Roman Empire. It's only later on after Constantine and when, you know, it became church and state.
Right.
And if you even look at that dynamic, it's never been a very good one. In fact, in the Orthodox Church, in Russian Orthodox Church, they said that the Romanov sealed their fate when they usurped the power from the bishops. You know, way back, you know, this was, you know, way, way back, the Muscovites and these people did that. And, you know, it's always been a problem, and, you know, I guess it always will be. But I think it's part of our cultural and maybe genetic makeup that we end up with, you know, a lot of violence. We are just violent people, I guess, you know, really. And it takes a lot, I think, for people to overcome that. I don't know what to say more about it. It's so complex.
Yeah. No, I think you've said it all. And all these crosses that you see this neo-Christian iconography that these Nazis are using is a total, absolutely right, John, total perversion of Christianity. And these guys should be appalled. John, thank you so much for the call. We'll be right back. We're reading today from The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shurer here on the Tom Hartman University Book Club. This is from the foreword by Shurer. He writes, "Though I lived and worked in the Third Reich during the first half of its brief life, watching at first hand Adolf Hitler consolidate his power as dictator of a great but baffling nation and then lead it off to war and conquest, this personal experience would not have led me to attempt to write this book had there not occurred at the end of World War II an event unique in history. This was the capture of most of the confidential archives of the German government and all its branches, including those of the Foreign Office, the Army and Navy, the National Socialist Party, and Heinrich Himmler's secret police. Never before, I believe, has such a vast treasure fallen into the hands of contemporary historians. Hitherto, the archives of a great state, even when it was defeated in war and its government overthrown by revolution, as happened to Germany and Russia in 1918, were preserved by it, and only those documents which served the interests of the subsequent ruling regime were ultimately published. The swift collapse of the Third Reich in the spring of 1945, however, resulted in the surrender not only of a vast bulk of its secret papers, but of other priceless materials, such as private diaries, highly secret speeches, conference reports, and correspondence, and even transcripts of telephone conversations of the Nazi leaders tapped by a special office set up by Hermann Göring in the Air Ministry. General Franz Halder, for example, kept a voluminous diary jotted down in Gabelsberger shorthand, not only from day to day, but from hour to hour throughout the day. It's a unique source of concise information for the period between August 14, 1939, and September 24, 1942, when he was chief of the Army staff and in daily contact with Hitler and the other leaders of Nazi Germany. It is the most revealing of the German diaries, but there are others of great value, including those of Dr. Joseph Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda and close party associate of Hitler, and of General Alfred Jodl, Chief of Operations of the High Command of the Armed Forces. That's the OKW. There are diaries of the OKW itself and of the Naval High Command. Indeed, the 60,000 files of the German Naval Archives, which were captured at Schloss Tambach near Coburg, contain practically all of the signals, ship's logs, diaries, memoranda, etc. of the German Navy from April 1945, when they were found, all the way back to 1868, when the modern German Navy was founded. The 485 tons of records of the German Foreign Office captured by the U.S. First Army in various castles and mines in the Harz Mountains, just as they were about to be burned on orders from Berlin, cover not only the period of the Third Reich, but go back to the Weimar Republic, to the beginning of the Second Reich of Bismarck. For many years after the war, tons of Nazi documents laid sealed in a large U.S. Army warehouse in Alexandria, Virginia. Our government showing no interest in even opening the packing cases to see what historical interest, documents of historical interest might lie within them. Finally, in 1955, 10 years after their capture, thanks to the initiative of the American Historical Association and the generosity of a couple of private foundations, the Alexandria papers were opened, and a pitifully small group of scholars with an inadequate staff and equipment went to work to sift through them and photograph them before the government, which is a great hurry in this matter, returned them to Germany. They proved a rich find. So did such documents as the partial stenographic record of 51 Führer conferences on the daily military situation as seen and discussed in Hitler's headquarters, and the fuller text of the Nazi warlord's table talk with his old party cronies and secretaries during the war. The first of these was rescued from the charred remains of some of Hitler's papers at Berchtesgaden by an intelligence officer of the U.S. 101st Airborne Division, and the second was found among Martin Bormann's papers. And he goes through and he lists some more of the stuff. And he says, "I have not read, of course, all of the staggering amount of documentation. It would be far beyond the power of any single individual. But I've worked my way through a considerable part of it, slowed down, as all toilers in this rich vineyard must be, by the lack of any suitable indexes. It is quite remarkable how little those of us who were stationed in Germany during the Nazi time, journalists and diplomats, really knew of what was going on behind the facade of the Third Reich. A totalitarian dictatorship, by its very nature, works in great secrecy and knows how to preserve that secrecy from the prying eyes of outsiders. It was easy enough to record and describe the bare, exciting, and often revolting events in the Third Reich, an Anschluss with Austria, the surrender of Chamberlain at Munich, the occupation of Czechoslovakia, the attacks on Poland, Scandinavia, the West, the Balkans and Russia, the horrors of the Nazi occupation and the concentration camps and the liquidation of the Jews. But the fateful decisions secretly made, the intrigues, the treachery, the motives and the aberrations which led up to them, the parts played by the principal actors behind the scenes, the extent of the terror they exercised and their technique of organizing it, all this and much more remained largely hidden from us until the secret German papers turned up. Some may think that it is much too early to try to write a history of the Third Reich, that such a task should be left to a later generation of writers to whom time has given perspective. I found this view especially prevalent in France when I went to do some research there. Nothing more recent than the Napoleonic era, I was told, should be tackled by writers of history. And then he goes on to kind of push back on that view. The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shirer. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Greg Palast, the investigative journalist with Truth Out and Rolling Stone, author and filmmaker of the new movie, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which you can find over at Amazon and other places. And Greg Palast, of course, .com, gregpalast.com, the website. And you can tweet him at Greg_Palast. Greg, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
It is always a pleasure and an honor to have you with us, my friend. Wow. So you have an 11-year-long employee, a guy who's been working for you for a decade for the Palast Investigative Fund, who was in Charlottesville, Virginia. Tell us the story.
Zach Roberts, who does our undercover filming and shooting. Zach D. Roberts is a brilliant investigative journalist who went down to Charlottesville, and he got something on camera that no one else seems to have gotten. There was a young black man, actually, he's a special ed teacher in his early 20s, named DeAndre Harris. He was walking along the crowd of white supremacists and neo-Nazis, his local school teacher, and just said, go home. You know, that was his big giant taunt. Go home. And they chased him down into a parking lot, a half a dozen neo-Nazis, with weapons, iron rods, shields, and smashed him through a parking, pushed him through a parking lot entry arm. The lumber broke. He fell to the ground. They picked up the lumber and smashed him over the head. They hit him with the iron bars. And then they started kicking him unconscious with their steel-tipped boots. And then when some of his friends just courageously ran down against these armed guys, they ran off, leaving one of their men with a 9mm Glock pistol, which he was going to use on the rescuers, except that our man, Zach Roberts, was there filming the whole thing. Thank God he had his camera up. Then he pointed the gun at Zach, who then remembered at that moment that he'd forgotten his bulletproof vest in the car. Shame on you, Zach. But he got the shot. Thank God the guy realized that pulling the trigger on a guy with a who would have it all on camera was not a wise idea. He concealed the gun and fled. This story, while it's gone viral through the net, and thank you, Tom, for putting it on your television show and now on radio. And these pictures are horrible.
Yeah,
these pictures could have been. In fact, Zach was thinking of turning them black and white, but he was afraid that which you usually do for newspapers. But he was afraid that people would think this is just some old shot from 1964 and the Ku Klux Klan beating up black protesters. This was just, it was horrible. And then later he was able to try to get an ambulance to the young man and interviewed him later after he recovered a bit.
Have you had any success in identifying the assailants, these thugs who beat up this young black man?
Well, that's interesting, Tom, that you would ask that, because I have read in the paper that the Justice Department under Jeff Beauregard Sessions is looking for the neo-Nazis that are killing people. we have not been contacted by the FBI, the Justice Department, nor even the Charlottesville Police Department, despite a complaint being filed. By the way, our man was threatened with a semi-automatic weapon. We've gotten no contact. No one seems to care. And you know what? And here's the problem. I mean, by the way, as the Palace Investigative Fund, our team would never give up a source. But we're talking about We have super high resolution raw footage, which could help identify these guys. The FBI has the files. They have the information. And they don't care. They haven't contacted this kid. He's filed a complaint. No one cares. We contact the police, nothing. FBI, nothing.
Wow.
This, and here's the problem, except for the wonderful Tom Hartman show, we're getting basically very little of the mainstream media noting that, yes, of course, it was much worse to have a neo-Nazi, I don't know why they call him neo-Nazi, he's a Nazi, who ran over a score of people killed this young woman.
Heather Heyer.
But that is, there's no comparison with pulling a gun on and beating the bejesus out of this this black school teacher. But still, the important point here is that the alt-right, so-called the alt-righteous, like to play the car incident. Well, that's one crazy guy. Well, I'm sorry, this was the whole phalanx of their march descended on one young black man and beat him. It's sickening to look at the photos. They're at gregpalace.com. I know that I hope that you're putting them up or people go to your
site. I've retweeted some of this stuff. Yes, absolutely.
And because you have to see it to believe it. Yep. I know it's not easy to look at, but please do, because you have to know what's going on in America and what and when. And, you know, our president said there's violence on many sides. The two sides I saw were the beaters and the kid that was being beaten and the guy with the gun and our guy with the camera. Now, tell me about the many sides of the violence.
Right. Yeah. Well, Trump also in the next sentence said we must cherish our history. And of course, the so-called protests, I'd call it a riot, were all about, protesting the loss of the statue of Robert E. Lee. I think on Saturday, and this was before Heather Heyer was murdered, I think he was just shouting out to them. But yes, let me encourage everybody to get over to gregpalace.com, check it out, tweet it, Facebook it, share it, email it, let all your friends know. And hopefully the Justice Department and the Charlottesville police will and the state of Virginia police will show some interest in this. This is mind-boggling. Greg, you're also somewhat of an expert on Venezuela and that situation. Trump last week said he's not ruling out military options in Venezuela. This is the first I've heard that we're on the brink of war with Venezuela. What the hell is going on down there?
Okay, I actually talked to the late President Hugo Chavez. He said, "I hope at that time Bush is not so stupid as to kill all our children." That's the phrase he used.
Wow,
kill all our children, and he met American children and Venezuelan children in a crazy operation. Look, Venezuela, it's a nation armed to the teeth, more armed than the United States, believe it or not. And you had, pro and anti-government demonstrators all armed to the teeth. About 60 people have been killed on each side. It's horrible. But understand, it is still, even Jimmy Carter, who does not like the Chavista regime, has said that they have the fairest elections in the Americas, much more than the United States. And yes, the people were very upset that without any oil money, the price of oil has plummeted, no more social programs and all these wonderful things that this incredible change in people's lives when the Chavez government gave out the oil wealth, which is brand new. It usually goes to Miami. He gave it out, but then the money ran out. Oil prices collapsed and the people got upset. They voted in an opposition Congress. By the way, they keep saying it's a dictatorship. I didn't know that dictators let the people vote in an opposition Congress. Then, like in the U.S., when people voted in Trump, angry at Obamacare, it wasn't what they thought it would be. They're angry and they voted in Trump. Suddenly, buyer's remorse, just as we see in the U.S., and there it took the form of a petition for a constitutional convention, and they just had a vote on that. 8 million people, a massive turnout for that vote. So it's a democracy, a thriving one, unfortunately, sometimes a violent one. But the last thing that should ever happen is to take those few crazy people with guns and add now artillery and our military. And I got to tell you one thing about Venezuelans. I know people, by the way, not only do I by the way, President Maduro showed up in my office a few years ago to talk about those other options that Trump talked about. One of them was kidnapping the president, which they did in 2002, the last president. They literally kidnapped the president. And right. The U.S., by the way, Here's a good one. The U.S. ambassador, when they kidnapped the president, ran down from the embassy and had his picture taken smiling with the hostage takers until they were arrested. You know, that's one option. And assassination's another option. I was able to uncover a plot to assassinate the then-president Chavez. Now military options. I do know that we stole, I was able in my investigations for BBC television to find out that the U.S. government had stolen the voter files of Venezuela. Now, I'm not going to say what mischief they did with those voter files because I don't know. I just know that the files of Venezuela were stolen by U.S. Homeland Security. Wow. What for? You tell me. So, look, the last thing we want is even the right-wing regime of Colombia, the right-wing regime of Argentina, they have all said, are you crazy? They literally told, our dear Vice President Pence, don't even discuss military options. We've had enough of military options in Latin America from the United States. Thank you.
Yeah. Wow. This is extraordinary. It's two absolutely extraordinary stories. What's going on in Venezuela? What happened in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend? Get over to gregpalace.com. You can read all about it. You can tweet to Greg at Greg_Palace. Nothing else. Say hi and thanks for being on our program. But share the good word. There's a lot of great information. And Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
Welcome.
It's always great talking. We'll be back. Hey, it's Tom with the Tom Hartman Program. You know I'm serious about my health and I'm doing something for it. You've heard me talking about Superbeets. I'm drinking Superbeets, a circulation superfood powder that helps support my heart and healthy blood pressure, too. I have amazing energy and stamina as well. The New York Times calls beets fitness in a glass. With Superbeets, I get all the benefits of beets without the bad taste or added sugar. Mix it in water or a smoothie for a jitter-free energy boost. You'll love the taste of Superbeets and feel results in as little as 20 minutes, guaranteed your money back. Try the original berry or black cherry. I love them both. If you haven't tried it yet, now is the time. Only for the summer, you can try Superbeets for only $5.95. Here's how. Call now and get a free box of Superbeets with 10 packets to try and feel the results, plus two free indicator strips for monitoring your nitric oxide levels before and after taking the Superbeets. It's just $5.95, and you'll love the results. Guaranteed. More energy, more stamina, support healthy circulation. What are you waiting for? Call 800-568-9889. That's 800-568-9889. Or go to tomsbeets.com. That's tomsbeets.com. Welcome back. Some other news. Somebody had called earlier and said, where are the veterans speaking out against Donald, not just Donald Trump, speaking out against the Nazis and the racists and the Klan members in Charlottesville, West Virginia. The Veterans of Foreign Wars, the VFW, an organization that my father and grandfather were both members of, today issued this press release. On behalf of the nearly 1.7 million members of the Veterans of Foreign Wars of the United States and its auxiliary, we extend our deepest condolences to the families of Heather Heyer, Virginia State Police Lieutenant H.J. Cullen and Trooper Burke M.M. Bates, and almost two dozen others who were injured Saturday when white nationalists clashed with counter-protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia. There is no reason or excuse great enough to justify violence against others just because you disagree with their ideology, backgrounds, religious beliefs, or ethnicities. Individuals and organizations who wave Nazi flags and who use the First Amendment as both shield and sword must be rooted out of our society and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law for fueling hate. There is no place in any civilized society for their ilk. This is by Keith Harmon, the national commander of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. They issued it as a press release today. I'm assuming it's also on their website at vfw.org. So there's that. Another story that, let me just follow up on this. The Run Them Down. Henry Graybar wrote a fascinating piece that is on Slate.com. And it's titled, Run Them Down, Driving Into Crowds of Protesters Was a Right-Wing Fantasy Long Before the Violence in Charlottesville.
And it starts out with a quote from ISIS's magazine, Rumaya, from last November. Quote, though being an essential part of modern life, very few actually comprehend the deadly and destructive capability of the motor vehicle and its capacity for reaping large numbers of casualties if used in a premeditated manner. So ISIS is using cars to kill people, and they've done this in a half a dozen or more cities. Run them over. These are just a few quotes here from Henry Graybar's piece. I encourage you to go over to slate.com and check this out. Run them over as a popular and anti-Black Lives Matter catchphrase. Even police officers have felt comfortable expressing this sentiment in public. In July 2016, after a week during which Alton Sterling and Philando Castile were shot and killed by police, and Micah Xavier Johnson killed five Dallas police officers in an apparent act of revenge, an Oregon police officer was fired after he posted a photo of Black Lives Matter protest and wrote, quote, when encountering such mobs, remember there are three pedals on your floor. Push the right one all the way down. In January 2016, a police sergeant in St. Paul, Minnesota, was suspended after allegedly posting a comment on an article about MLK Day, instructing drivers, quote, run them over, keep traffic flowing, and don't slow down for any of these idiots who try and block the street. This February, Troy Baker, president of the police union in Santa Fe, New Mexico, shared an image from the Prepare to Take America Back Facebook page, a right-wing meme factory. Quote, all lives splatter. Nobody cares about your protest, it reads over an image of a Jeep plowing through a crowd. On July 10, 2016, the same day a South Carolina fire captain threatened to run over Black Lives Matter protesters who had shut down Interstate 126, an SUV driver in Southern Illinois plowed through a group of BLM protesters after yelling, all lives matter, not blacks, all lives. 2 days earlier, a driver had accelerated into a crowd of protesters outside the police department in Ferguson, Missouri. In January 2015, a Minneapolis driver lurched into a Ferguson solidarity rally and ran over a 16-year-old girl. Across the country, Republican legislators have attempted to codify the idea that protesters surrender their rights when they stand on the road. And then he talks about Keith Kempenick, K-E-M-P-E-N-I-C-H, a trucking company CEO and North Dakota state legislator who has proposed a bill in the North Dakota House of Representatives to give immunity to drivers who unintentionally hit pedestrians on the road. The North Carolina House approved a similar bill in April. Lawmakers in Texas and Florida have proposed the same. And by the way, after Heather Heyer was killed, a Massachusetts patrolman commented on Facebook, ha ha ha, love this. Maybe people shouldn't block roadways.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Running them down is not something new, and it's not just ISIS that's doing it. It's also the Klan. It's the alt-right in the United States. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is one of the finest investigative reporters working in the United States. Li Fang, the investigative reporter with The Intercept. TheIntercept.com is the website. You can tweet him at LHFANG or at The Intercept. And Li, welcome back to the program. It's been too long since we've had you on.
It's been way too long. Tom, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to hear your voice, my friend. You wrote a piece that dropped my jaw when I read it. It was published a couple days ago, as I recall, over at TheIntercept.com. The title of it was Sphere of Influence, How American Libertarians Are Remaking Latin American Politics. We've seen the kind of libertarian takeover of the Republican Party or infiltration of the Republican Party here in the United States, but Latin America, tell us the story.
This is really the first look at a group called the Atlas Network. This organization has been around since the early 80s, but essentially their purpose is to take the successful economic hard right strategies for implementing those types of policies in the United States and the UK, and to duplicate that method that we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years here in country after country all over the world. Our piece takes a special focus on their efforts in Latin America, but what they've done is essentially taken the model of groups like the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and their kind of orbit of media outlets and duplicated this process in countries like Brazil and Argentina, but also in Eastern Europe and in other parts of the developing world.
So, to the best of my knowledge, there has never been a successful country, county, state, municipality that has operated along libertarian lines. Please correct me if I'm wrong. There have been a number of attempts, you know, the experiment with Chile that Milton Friedman was behind, the Donald Rumsfeld and L. Paul Bremer in Iraq, you know, literally closing down the entire government, believing that the free market would magically fill that space. That didn't work out so well. But what's, you know, the way libertarianism seems to play out in the United States is it just moves us in the direction of oligarchy. What's the end game in Latin America, and what do you think about my analysis of this?
Well, you know, in one respect, this is kind of a long-running debate that kind of predates all these terms that we use, like neoliberalism or economic libertarianism. You know, there's been an effort by the very wealthy in society to grab the gains of a society and keep it for themselves. So, you know, these libertarian policies of tax cuts for the rich, mass privatization, attacks on voting and kind of mass democracy and labor unions, it's nothing new. But what the Atlas Network provides is kind of the institutes that provide credibility for these ideas. You know, these institutes are kind of designed to look very academic. They provide kind of an ideological and academic veneer to these ideas so that they seem more popular than they really are, and that allows usually conservative politicians in these countries to then point to these third-party institutions and say, you know, if we're going to privatize, you know, the pension system, or we're going to privatize prisons and the education system, as they're trying to do in Brazil now, you know, these aren't ideas that simply benefit the very wealthy. Here's an independent third-party group that's making the recommendation. You know, and just like in the United States, there's kind of dark money financing efforts by the very wealthy and large industrial conglomerates to prop up these institutes. But for, you know, the general public and for the media, it's very convenient to see kind of like what looks like a credible third-party think tank that's providing these ideas and producing policy papers.
Is it mostly Central and South American billionaires and multimillionaires who are financing this, or is it American billionaires and multimillionaires?
Yeah, that's a very interesting dynamic. You know, there's been, and this, my piece kind of touches on the financing. You know, we don't know the exact financing for every single one of these institutes, but we've figured out that despite all their anti-government rhetoric, that the State Department and USAID, the foreign aid arm of the U.S. government, has quietly partnered with libertarian billionaires like the Koch brothers in the United States to work through the Atlas Network to provide financing and startup financing to these Latin American think tanks, which they train the leaders of these local institutes to then also rely on local financing from businesses in their home countries. So it's really a mix. It's a mix of very kind of politically active foundations in the United States. It's the State Department, which is funding these institutes to kind of shape countries to be more friendly to U.S. interests, and local businessmen from, you know, wherever the institute is based. So, you know, in Brazil, they're working with a lot of the economic elite in that country. But for the think tanks in Chile, they mix in financing from local businesses there.
Does this have to do, or what does this have to do, I guess, with you know, the overthrow of the president of Brazil recently, the, you know, what's going on in Venezuela, the rise of right wing governments? I mean, to what extent is this ideology actually fueling regime change or something close to it, as opposed to simply pushing government policies in one direction or the other?
Well, you know, it's important to kind of acknowledge that there's no one dynamic driving the kind of political shifts that we're seeing in Latin America right now. It's really a mix. And this is the kind of argument that the president of the Atlas Network, Alex Choflin, made to me when I interviewed him. You know, he can't take responsibility for the drop in commodity prices that led to a lot of, you know, instability. He can't take full responsibility for the political scandals that have kind of swept countries like Brazil. But what he can do is, you know, provide a network of institutes that are all working together that when these crises do arise, can take advantage of them to push ideas that were once on the margins of society into the mainstream. So, you know, Brazil, their economy has had a downturn because of lower commodity prices. There's been the sprawling corruption scandal that has touched every single major political party, including the conservative parties. But a new Atlas Network-backed group of think tanks and institutes, about 13 of them in Brazil, have channeled public outrage only on the leftist politicians, only on Dilma Rousseff, and basically made the argument that the only way to fix Brazil is to get rid of socialist policies and to ignore, you know, the corruption scandals that have affected the conservative parties, and to only get to encourage people to only get angry at politicians connected to the Workers' Party in Brazil. So they've really kind of skillfully exploited this crisis for their own political goals.
How is this different from the shock doctrine that Naomi Klein wrote about a number of years ago?
Well, there are many kind of interesting connections to that. You know, the Atlas Network was founded in 1981. What Naomi Klein writes about is how, with the military coup and Operation Condor in countries like Chile and the kind of attempt by libertarian economists from the University of Chicago to go down and use these countries in crisis as petri dishes to experiment with these massive libertarian policies. The book is brilliant, and I recommend anyone, any of your listeners, to read it. Well, you know, the Atlas Network years later came in to these very same countries, including Chile, working with the same group of University of Chicago economists to set up institutes to continue those reforms, to ensure that the ideas that were experimented with under Pinochet, for example, would be continued to be pushed even after Pinochet left. So, you know, Chile has a big presidential election this year. Sebastian Peña, the very conservative candidate, has actually leaned on the same set of University of Chicago-style libertarian think tanks in Chile to basically set up his cabinet of advisors. And his advisors have already said, if Peña wins, he will lean on these same institutes to go back to these types of libertarian reforms.
Some year or two ago, Jimmy Carter was on this program, and I asked him what he thought about Citizens United and how it's affected democracy in the United States. And he said, I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close. It went viral. It's all easy to find on the internet. He said, basically, the United States is no longer a democracy. We are now an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery, thanks to the Supreme Court. I would argue that that is the outcome of libertarian policies. To what extent should we simply start referring to so-called libertarianism as oligarchy? I mean, is it not that?
No, I think we need a broader debate, because I think a lot of people, you know, they take civil libertarian ideas like, you know, ending the drug war and marriage equality, and they equate them with economic libertarian ideas, which are really, I think, from an intellectual basis, completely different. This is basically an attempt to rebrand old style ideas that are based in feudalism, that are based in a very hierarchical society, and we need a larger discussion about the problems we face. And unfortunately, I think the term libertarian throws people off, because they mix up the economic libertarian side with the civil libertarian side.
Yeah, and the economic libertarian side is really basically a scam, and the civil libertarian is, you know, yeah, we'll throw you a bone. You know, gay people can get married. You know, we don't care. It's not going to hurt the billionaires. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Get over to TheIntercept.com and read this piece, Sphere of Influence by Lee Fong, and check it out. This is absolutely brilliant reporting. Lee, thanks so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you for having me. Take care.
Always great talking with you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Boy, what a day. There's so much going on here. Mike in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Well, I have a theory about all of the these right-wing senators and congressmen denouncing Trump from what he said last weekend. And I think it's more self-preservation than anything.
Oh, it's half self-preservation, and in the case of people like Cory Gardner and Marco Rubio, half they want to run for president in 2 years, 3 years.
Right. Well, Cory Gardner was one. Was something that was a person that I wanted to bring up a couple of weeks ago. The Denver Post had an article that basically said that cows are coming home, or the chickens are coming home to roost for Gardner. And I think he's realizing that what he's said and done in the past is coming home to haunt him. They had a meeting with Gardner, Michael Bennett, Governor Hickenlooper, and Zinke down in Durango about the Gold King mine disaster here a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody asked a question about the Gold King mine.
Mm-hmm.
They just peppered him with questions about the ACA. So I think he's realizing that his thoughts and actions of the past almost 2 years he's been in office are coming back to haunt him.
And let us not forget, I mean, when Cory Gardner was first running for the United States Senate, just prior to that, he had been an enthusiastic supporter of the personhood legislation. Personhood legislation basically says that, from the moment of conception, a fertilized egg is a human being. And it is murder to arguably take some kinds of birth control it would outlaw actually most types of birth control. It would outlaw, all forms of abortion. And Cory Gardner was right there with those guys. And in the week before the election, this just made me absolutely crazy. One of the conservative journalists on NPR, a national political reporter who had to get a waiver to be a Fox contributor, she's so conservative, went on NPR and said, oh, Cory Gardner's not in favor of the personhood amendment. He's a rational, normal guy, and just whitewashed his background. And he won an election that was essentially a squeaker. And I think he won that because, NPR has a hell of a throw across the United States. And it just horrified me. I went off on it several days in a row, back then. But Cory Gardner is looking from here, and you live in Colorado. You tell me. He looks to me like he's just basically a naked opportunist. He'll say whatever it takes to get him elected.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that is absolutely right. And you'll notice If you ever notice when the turtle speaks, the guy on the far left with the gray, with the salt and pepper hero, that's Gardner, who's
right.
Sitting at
with Mitch McTurtle,
McCobb's shoulder, who sits at the turtle's shoulder.
Yeah. He's it's amazing. I mean, he's a first term senator, and how close to power he's got, and how quickly he's rising in the Republican Party. He's good looking. He's white. He's got a good CV. Of course. Mike, thanks for the call. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest news and information from Wall Street and Main Street, all points in between, plus best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, show up, participate, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.